Welcome to special episode 31 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe and Johnson. Thank you for joining us. We told you we were going on hiatus for the month of August, but might return for special events. And this is a special event. The Federalist Society held a debate of sorts on the latest version of the USA Freedom Bill introduced by Senator Leahy. Christian Corrigan moderated the discussion, which was between me and Harley Geiger, the senior counsel and deputy director for Freedom, Security, and Surveillance at the Center for Democracy and Technology. We had a fine hour-long discussion and rather surprisingly achieved a measure of agreement on two pretty divisive issues: how to handle specific selection terms, something that nearly brought the House bill to its knees, and a new issue that I raised, which is the need for ethics and conflict standards for anyone who's going to act as a special advocate in the FISA court. But listen to this. That's a great workout for those who are trying to understand what Senator Leahy's bill does. Now, let's get started.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group Teleform Conference Call on Privacy and National Security, the Merits of the Leahy FISA Reform Bill. My name is Christian Corrigan, and I'm Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we're pleased to welcome two experts on the topic. The first is Stuart A. Baker, who is a partner at Steptoe & Johnson, and the second is Harley Geiger, who is Senior Counsel and Deputy Director at the Freedom, Security, and Surveillance Project at the Center for Democracy and Technology. More complete bios for our speakers were provided to you in notice of the call, so I'll stop there to preserve more time for their presentations, followed by your questions. So without anything more, I think I'll go ahead and turn the floor over to Harley Geiger, who's going to go ahead and get us started. So the floor is yours.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and thank you for having me. So we are talking about the USA Freedom Act, and the big picture it is that Senator Leahy's new version of the USA Freedom Act is a major improvement from the version that passed the U.S. House of Representatives a few months ago. And that is the perspective that's shared by many public interest groups and major U.S. technology companies. And many of those same technology companies are currently seeing their businesses and their reputations suffer both in the United States and abroad as a result of some of the surveillance revelations over the past year. We are also receiving reports that the administration is behind this version and that the intelligence community can at least accept it, although we have not yet seen any official public statement. So, importantly, we believe that Senator Leahy's new version of the USA Freedom Act most likely achieves its goal of ending the bulk collection of Americans' communications data, which the House version did not. And at the same time, we believe that the bill preserves the flexibility that intelligence agencies need to protect national security. For many of the privacy and civil liberties groups, as well as the companies going into discussions about USA Freedom as the bill was being drafted and refined and discussed in Congress, the desire was not just to get as strong privacy protections as possible, but rather to strike a balance that still preserves national security. It is widely understood in the privacy community that a terrorist attack is just about the worst thing that can happen for civil liberties, and no one wants that to happen. And so we believe that part of the reason that this bill is worthy of our support is that it achieved that balance. So I'm going to focus on bulk collection and the prohibition on bulk collection. But the Senate bill essentially does three main things. It aims to ban bulk collection under Section 215 of the Patriot Act, the Pen Trap Statute, and national security letters. It also has some FISA court reforms and also some transparency requirements for the government and some transparency authorizations for private companies. But for many of us, the main issue was prohibiting bulk collection. So I'm going to focus on that, but I'm willing to talk about the other topics if that comes up. So like the House bill, the Senate bill aims to prohibit bulk collection by requiring that the government use a specific selection term in its request for data. And thus, the definition of specific selection term becomes a very critical provision. And basically, a specific selection term is an identifier of some kind that is used to define the scope of the surveillance request. And in the House bill, that definition was ambiguous enough that neither the groups, nor the companies, nor many of the bill's co-sponsors had confidence that the bill would, in fact, end bulk collection. So although the House bill did pass with strong support, which indicates there's great appetite in Congress to reform surveillance authorities, many of the groups ended up pulling their support. The major tech companies pulled their support. And in fact, the majority of the members of the House that voted against the bill were the bill's co-sponsors. And some of the ambiguities in the House bill are the possibility that the House bill could be used to justify, for example, the use of a broad swath of geography as a specific selection term, or the name of a large corporation such as Verizon or Google as a specific selection term, and therefore it would not be, in fact, a prohibition on bulk collection. Now, the Senate bill clarifies these ambiguities. The Senate bill specifically makes clear that a broad geographic region, such as a state or a zip code, cannot be used as the specific selection term unless it's used in conjunction with another specific selection term, such as we want Harley in D.C. as opposed to we want everyone in D.C. Same thing with electronic communication services, such as Google or Verizon, that they cannot just simply name the ECS or RCS. They have to include another specific selection term in the ECS or RCS. And importantly, the Senate bill also adds in front-end and back-end protections. And we think that this is crucial because this is where a lot of the privacy and flexibility balance is actually implemented. At the front end, the specific selection term, according to the bill, is required to narrowly limit to the greatest extent practicable the scope of information sought, consistent with the purpose for seeking the information. So it has a front-end narrowly limiting requirement. At the back end, the bill adds in minimization requirements for broad requests. So the statute currently requires the government to have minimization procedures for surveillance requests under Section 215. And the Senate bill adds to these minimization procedures when the request is not for an individual account or personal device. So for those requests, the requests that are broader than individual account or personal device, the government must either make a determination within a reasonable time period that the information is related to a foreign power or agent of a foreign power or indicates a threat of death or serious bodily harm, or the government must destroy the data. So I know that that's a lot of information, but the important point is this. The government retains the power to ask for many records at once. So if they need the records of every purchase from the beauty shop or every guest in the hotel or every passenger in the airline, they can still get it. They can still name a person as the specific selection term. They can name a store as a specific selection term. However, when they do that, they're not asking for an individual's information. They're asking for a entity's information. And so they are required to either determine that there is a threat or an investigation related to this information, or they have to flush the data. So the bill does other things as well, as I mentioned, FISA court reform and transparency. There, too, we think that it's a major improvement over the House. It adds in a panel of amici with a mandate to advocate in favor of privacy as appropriate, the bill says, but it still leaves a great deal of discretion for the FISA court. So we view the bill as a compromise. We certainly did not get everything that we want. The bill does not cover, for example, Section 702 of FISA or the rights of non-U.S. persons or other issues related to national security surveillance. But the bill was never advertised as being a complete solution to many of the problems that we've now learned about. However, the goal of many companies and groups was to end the large-scale collection of communications data about Americans not connected to a crime. And we think that this bill, if followed faithfully, achieves this with relative effectiveness. And at the same time, we think that the bill provides the government with a reasonable level of flexibility. And so CDT, along with many groups, many tech companies, supports Leahy's bill as written, and we urge Congress to pass it without weakening its provisions. And I'll turn it over to Stuart.
Thanks, Harley. So we agree on some things, minor ones, but real, and disagree on some pretty important bigger issues. I would say that on the question of ending bulk collection, we disagree on the question of whether the Senate bill with respect to specific selection terms is an improvement on the House. I think it's an improvement from security as well as privacy point of view. And so in that regard, which is the bulk of what you were talking about, we probably do agree. I think that the additional provisions, especially about special advocates, are pretty dangerous, and I'll talk a little bit about that. So let me cover the three points. First, getting rid of bulk collection. Let's remember why this program was started. It was started because there was a call made to a safe house we were monitoring in Yemen by an al-Qaeda member, and NSA was unable to determine that that call came from the United States and was unable to therefore quickly trace other people who had been talking also from the United States to that number about the attack. And the result is it was one of the reasons we failed to stop the attacks. And this is not an unrealistic worry for the future. The most dangerous attacks that we will face are attacks that are planned for, trained for, totally prepared outside the United States in some safe haven by Islamic terrorists who then infiltrate the United States, maintain communications with their planners outside the United States, and then carry out a devastating attack inside the United States. And the best way to deal with that threat is to be able to quickly graph, identify those communications and graph the connections among the people that are planning the attack. That's what that database was designed to do. The solution that is proposed as a substitute by both the House and the Senate bills is to say, no, you just give, you go to the phone companies and you ask the phone companies to give you that information, and then you take whatever they happen to have, and you take whatever system they happen to have, whatever format that data is in, and you struggle your way through the connections that those people may have to each other. A very difficult process, and one that will be dramatically harmed by the fact that most phone companies do not keep records of this kind for any particularly long period of time. It's probably less than a year for most of them, maybe less than 6 months in some cases. So we won't be able to actually get a picture of what this person who's talking to a suspect outside the United States has been doing inside the United States. Very troubling, very risky, and done, frankly, in the name of a principle that only a lawyer can love, that somehow, because the data is in the hands of the National Security Agency, subject to all kinds of restrictions on search, that that's worse than leaving it in the hands of the phone companies and getting it with subpoenas. It's certainly not a, much of a bulwark against the fascist knight that everyone seems to fear, and it imposes massive costs on our ability to efficiently identify some of the most serious threats we face. So getting rid of bulk data is something that, frankly, I think we will all regret, and we will all ask ourselves, what was the point of that anyway exactly? So that's problem one. But if we're going to do that, it does seem to me that what the Senate bill does is an improvement from the point of view of security. That's because the House bill, which was largely drafted by the privacy groups, included language that said you can only ask for certain selection terms, names and the like. And if it doesn't fall, if it isn't a name, you can't go searching for it. And I have used the example of Zazi, the guy who wanted to blow up tunnels in New York, who was going around buying the acetone for his bomb from beauty shops in Denver, Colorado. And if the FBI had wanted to find everybody who bought acetone in the Denver area in large quantities, under the House bill, the answer would have been, I'm sorry, that's not a name, that's not an entity, that's not an address, that's not a device, you can't ask about that, which is crazy. The Senate bill actually cuts back on the terms, but it makes it possible to say we have narrowed this in an effective way, so we're only asking about customers who bought large quantities of acetone in a particular period, in a particular area, and you don't have to worry about whether it falls into some magic category that the House of Representatives has adopted. So if Harley is happy with it from a privacy point of view, I do think it's actually an improvement from a security point of view. Last point that I would address is the special advocate position. The House had a provision that said if the FISA court wants to have amicus help, they have authority to do it, and they would have a panel of people they could choose from. The Senate bill builds on that to insist that the President's Civil Liberties Oversight, the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, be part of choosing the panel of representatives, and it gives those representatives not only a mandate to always argue for privacy and civil liberties, but also a set of authorities, including the authority to go back and read, as far as I can tell, every decision ever written by the FISA court, even in the most sensitive programs that are not directly in dispute, and to ask questions about them, to share that information with other advocates, cleared, of course, but essentially it takes some of our most sensitive intercept capabilities and puts them in the hands of a bunch of people who are committed to less intelligence, less effective intelligence, more privacy, and a less capable intelligence community, and indeed imposes on them, and this is something that I would have thought the Federalist Society members would be quite sensitive to, it imposes on them no obligations with respect to ethical and conflict of interest obligations. And so, these folks will not be paid to sit around waiting for a fire. They will have day jobs. We have to ask, well, what day jobs will they have? Eventually, maybe they'll be paid for their time, but we all know that those kind of systems, when you implement them, are best carried out by campaigning advocacy groups that confront the money and get it back 3 years later when they get an award. So what 501c3s or advocacy groups are going to raise money on the basis that they have a particular, they have a guy who's been named to the advocacy group. Are they going to go to the Middle East and say, you know, you could get a whole lot more attention to the disparate impact of these orders on the Middle East or Americans of Arabic extraction if you helped fund our activities so that we could keep this guy sitting around waiting to participate in a particular case? Or if they are, like me, sitting around at private firms representing companies and they happen to have a clearance because of that, well, one, they have a clearance because it's useful to some government agency. We don't know necessarily which one. That may turn out to be relevant to the question of what their views are going to be. And they have clients. How do we know those clients will not have conflict of interest with certain kinds of arguments and not with others? And how do we know that those interests will not influence the arguments that are made by these special advocates? We have no assurances whatsoever and really no way to even investigate this under the Senate bill. So it seems to me that the massive exposure of large amounts of data, something that the Judicial Conference has criticized, and the lack of any enforceable ethical standards with respect to how that information is used in front of the court seems to me to be creating a series of future problems that we will also regret. Thanks.
This is Christian Corgan. Harley, do you want to take a couple minutes to respond to anything that that Stuart?
Yes, please.
Go ahead.
Okay. First, I'm pleased to hear that that Stuart, it sounds like overall on the bulk collection points, agrees that the Senate bill is an improvement from the House bill from the perspective of security. As I said, we I think that the hope of everybody is that it does not undermine security in its endeavor to protect privacy and end bulk collection. Now, on the broader point of whether ending bulk collection is advisable, it's important, I think, to recognize that what we're talking about here is not just the bulk collection of landline records. Now, that is the program that the NSA and the Department of Justice had implemented, but they had claimed the authority to collect other types of records in bulk, including internet metadata, so your email metadata, essentially anything that shows a relationship between people, so perhaps also cell phone location, financial information. So this is a pretty broad authority, not just the landline records. And that type of authority, as the PCLOB, the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, had said, and as CDT agrees, does redefine the relationship between individuals and the state. It is incredibly broad, and Congress should at least have some input into how that is being used, given that at least members of Congress claim this is an unforeseen use of the statutory framework they set up in the Patriot Act. To Stuart's example about the call made to the Safe House that we were monitoring, the government can certainly still get that information. If the Safe House is one that we are monitoring, then there is no reason to that the government would not be able to demand the records from that caller, from the phone company. And under the Senate bill, they can still get two hops out. They will be able to pull that directly from the phone company, and they can do so on a daily basis. It is in fact quite similar in many respects to the program that exists currently, except that with the crucial difference that the NSA is not pulling in all of the calls for everyone in the country, but rather for their list of targets. Stuart, you had mentioned that you would simply have to live with whatever solution, whatever format the phone companies have it in, but the bill does provide for a technical assistance requirement whereby the government can demand that the recipient of the call detail order, so presumably the large telecoms, would have to provide technical assistance to get the information into a format that the government can find usable. On the discussion of whether phone companies keep the information for 6 months or more than a year, some of them keep it for many, many years. I think that Senator Ed Markey had asked many of the telecoms for as part of a letter with many questions, but one of the questions that Markey had asked was what their data retention periods were. And if I recall correctly, T-Mobile and Sprint kept their information for something like 20 years. So many of them keep it for longer than a year. I think that 18 months was pretty standard. In terms of whether it's worse to leave it with the NSA or to have it with the phone companies, there's a big difference between the two. The phone companies are already generating these records, and the phone companies cannot put you in jail. On the last point, with regard to the special advocate, so the special advocate provisions in the Senate bill still leave, as I said, a great deal of flexibility for the FISA court. The FISA court, they have to work in consultation with the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board on the panel, but the FISA court ultimately chooses them. The FISA court also gets to decide when the special advocate actually gets to participate in a case. The FISA court can make a determination. It must do so in writing, but it can make a determination that it is not appropriate to take on a special advocate in a particular case, in which case it can decline to use the special advocate. And the Senate bill also gives the government specifically discretion to decline to share with the special advocates any privileged material. And as Stuart noted, the special advocates would have to be cleared, that is made clear in the Senate bill. They'd have to have a security clearance and, of course, would be under strict rules not to divulge any classified information. And, you know, on the point of the mandate, whether they, you know, the fact that the bill does set forth a mandate saying that the special advocates are to advocate, it says, as appropriate for privacy and civil liberties. That was an important point for many, because otherwise, if there was no special mandate for the advocates, then they could just as easily argue in favor of greater government surveillance. And it would start to resemble the powers that the FISA court already inherently possesses as a court, because the FISA court can, regardless of these bills, if it wants to, call upon amici as it wishes. And clearly that power was not sufficient to prevent these rather scandalous interpretations of law. On the point of a conflict of interest, I find that very interesting. I think that's actually a very good point. And I am curious to talk with Stuart some more about what might be an appropriate remedy for that. It's perhaps interesting to note that my own organization, my employer, Center for Democracy and Technology, does have a member of PCLOB in our ranks. Our Vice President, Jim Dempsey, is on the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board. And some of you who are watching what the PCLOB does may recall that they recently came out with a report on Section 702 of FISA and determined that they thought that the program was okay, basically. They thought it was not in need of a great deal of serious reform. This breaks very clearly with CDT's institutional position. So in terms of the conflict of interest, so far that's been my experience, is watching these individuals with a great deal of independence from their day jobs. And then very lastly, a minor point, Stuart, you had mentioned that this is something that the Judicial Conference has criticized. Most recently, there was a letter from Judge John Bates, who spoke, he says, on behalf of the judiciary. And although John Bates is the director of the Administrative Office of U.S. Courts, it is questionable whether he does, in fact, speak on behalf of the judiciary, as two other former FISA court judges have spoken out in favor of these reforms. Thank you.
So let me just take 2 minutes to respond to a couple of those things. I think we're mostly in agreement on the Senate versus the House bill, at least on this special selection term point. In terms of, I think Harley is understating how difficult this will be for anybody who wants to track someone when they find a call to a Yemen's or maybe a Mosul safe house. They won't be able to just identify the caller. They will have to ask 10 or 15 or 20 different carriers, did you have any calls to this number? Because we're trying to find out where it might have come from. They don't know for sure it came from the U.S., so they're asking these guys. They have to ask China Mobile. They'll have to ask a bunch of people that they may not really be comfortable exposing their intelligence targets to about these questions, and they'll have to ask all of them. And then if one of them misses or they miss the right company, and Lord knows that if you're a terrorist, you'd be wise to use some podunk carrier that's below the cutoff line for those kinds of requests, they just won't get it. Then when they get information, they will get what the company stores, and companies store their billing data for a long time. But if you've read a bill recently, it says for monthly services, long distance and local calls. It doesn't tell you what calls you made, and those numbers are rarely held anything like 20 years or really, frankly, 18 months. So we will lose a lot of data there. And as for the question, can the phone companies put you in jail? No, they can't, but they also can't save you from terrorism on their own. The government has the authority to put people in jail because it has a mission that is, in many respects, more important, more existential than the mission of commercial enterprises. But I am glad to hear Harley's peace offering on the question of conflict of interest. I think it is a real lack, and we need to address it. We can't all count on or always count on people like Jim Dempsey and their independence. Though I certainly do honor his independence from his organization in setting forth his views on the P-Club. But as Ronald Reagan used to say, you need to trust and you need to verify.
This is Christian Corrigan, and if you are ready, we can go ahead and go to the audience. I'm sure we've got a bunch of So in a moment for our audience, we will open the floor mode. You'll hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. And after that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. And while we're waiting for the first question, a quick programming note. Harley mentioned the latest PCLOB report on Section 702. Well, this Thursday, our next scheduled Teleform conference call, August 14th at noon, we will have two members of the P-Club. First, Jim Dempsey, who Harley mentioned, as well as Rachel Brand, and they'll be discussing the report and taking your questions. So please be sure to join us Thursday at noon for that Teleform.
Well, do you think I could put in a plug for the Steptoe Cyber Law podcast, which covers these issues every day? Every week, we put out a one-hour podcast with about half an hour of news and then a detailed interview with some newsmaker in the area of privacy and security. And I've interviewed David Medin about his both of the reports that came out of his board. And as you might expect from my views, they are not a festival of agreement, but they certainly are enlightening for people who follow these issues.
And if we're putting out plugs, then I would encourage you all to visit the Center for Democracy and Technology, cdt.org. We do have a lot of resources on the Senate bill, this USA Freedom Act, as well, like including a comparison between the Senate bill and the House bill, as well as many other issues on technology policy. And if you have any questions, please feel free to email me at harley@cdt.org.
Fantastic. Well, it looks like we have one question on the line that we'll go to, and our lines will be open. So, again, if you'd like to ask a question of either or both of our experts, press star and then the pound key.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. I don't see any sign in this bill or any other proposed legislation in this field that would put restrictions on the use of information acquired from third parties and voluntarily provided to the agencies. It sounds to me like we may be whacking a few moles, but leaving most of the mole holes open. And, you know, what is one of the practices that has traditionally been done is for the U.S. to have the Brits collect intelligence on our people while we collect intelligence on theirs, and then we just swap the intelligence. And, you know, if the credit reporting agencies, for example, get in the business of bulk surveillance, which they could do, and simply voluntarily provide the information, we still have the same problem. We've just outsourced it. So, and the other thing is that perhaps we ought to take a look at approaches like putting a cap on the number of persons or communications that could be surveilled, such that if the threshold were exceeded, some data would have to be destroyed that represented a lower threat level, so that we were all never looking at more than, say, 6% of all communications or individuals.
Well, that last idea is certainly a novel one, or creative, I think, and the idea of a budget, much like the regulatory budget, has some appeal, although I'd sort of want to know that we also had a cap on the number of people who could engage in jihad against the United States, and so far that number doesn't look like it's capped at 6% of the U.S. population. So I'm wary of that. On the other hand, there are provisions in the USA Freedom Act for saying that if you gather information under one of these special selection terms by narrowing it, when you have gone through it and found the stuff that you're really interested in, there are provisions requiring the destruction of the stuff that turned out not to be relevant, which is a novel approach to some of the civil liberties issues that people have been concerned about. And I think in this context, at least, probably does make sense. I should say, finally, though, that I've been hearing since the 90s when I was at NSA this as far as I can tell, utterly false claim that the Brits and the Americans swap intelligence gathering on each other's nationals. In fact, when I was there, and as far as I can tell to this day, there have been restrictions in which the U.S. makes it clear they won't engage in that kind of swapping with the Brits or anybody else. So I really think that's that part of your question was based on a misapprehension of the facts, although I recognize a durable misapprehension of the facts.
I would only add that there are some requirements in law, such as the Section 222 of the Communications Act, that does prohibit the government from, or prohibit companies from turning over things like call records to the government without the customer's consent or legal process. And granted, that does not cover all of the scenarios that you described. But as I said, this particular bill is definitely not advertised as solving all of the problems that one could find with national security surveillance. It's really targeted at the bulk collection, transparency, and FISA court issues that have arisen. So, you know, we would join you in calling for Congress to exercise some more judgment and oversight over the use of some of these authorities. But for the purposes of this bill, we view it as relatively effective in what it is trying to do.
Great. Well, this is Christian Corgan. Our lines are open, so if you'd like to press star, pound. Quickly back, Stuart, Harley mentioned the conflict of interest concerns and said he might be interested in your thoughts on some remedies there. Do you want to offer any thoughts on that, on what might be able to be done?
Yeah, it seems to me that at a minimum there ought to be disclosure of any relationships that could cause a conflict in the context of people in private practice, their clients who may have an interest in the way that FISA is administered. In the case of 501c3s, it probably means disclosure of their donors and of any circumstances where they have referenced the fact that one of their employees plays this role in the context of fundraising. That's off the top of my head, those are the things that I would be most immediately concerned about, but probably also there ought to be a look at who's holding the clearances for this party, and do they have an interest in the outcome? Maybe the clearances should not be held by agencies that might have a stake in the outcome of a particular case.
You know, Stuart, as a practical matter, some of those nonprofits who refuse to accept donations from corporate entities you might disagree with them more strenuously on their surveillance positions.
Oh, absolutely, and I think that it's certainly possible that they're getting donations from parties who have of interest in how they advocate before the tribunal. And I think that anyone who donates, whether they're an individual or a company, with a view to encouraging a particular point of view being raised in the court is doing something that we should consider inappropriate.
Although that likely covers a very large swath of people.
Yes.
most of the nonprofits anyway, try to very fiercely protect their independence from their donors. And obviously in practice, it may not be 100% independent, but there's quite a bit of tension many times between the positions that a nonprofit takes and their donors.
I'm just trying to make it easy for them to say no. They say if you give me money that's tied in any way to this, if I even talk to you about the fact that we have litigated in this area, I will lose. You know, our guy will lose his position. So don't come to me. Don't send me letters about how you hope I'll raise this point or that. Don't send me checks that are designed to pay for my counsel in the special advocate program. We really need to be cleaner than Caesar's wife, and we're just not going to let any influence from funders affect what we do.
Well, I agree with that. And at least in the case of USA Freedom, they do have an appropriations provision that allows Congress to appropriate funds as necessary to implement the provisions for the special advocate. Whether that means the special advocate will get paid, I do not know, but the provision is there and would in fact put those funds under the direction of the administrator of the United States courts, who happens to be John Bates.
Yes, I think, you know, an authorization for an appropriation and $3 will get you to Capitol Hill from DuPont Circle on the Metro. It's a long haul to getting an actual appropriation, and to the extent that the payments are sort of retroactive based on, you know, the hours you spent, they're only institutional. No individual can front 3 years worth of litigation and then get paid.
It is an interesting problem.
Well, it looks like we had another question jump on the line, so we'll go right to that.
Yes, this is David Emerson, a society member in Berkeley, California. I mean, I appreciate the comments the speakers have on this current FISA proposal. The question I have that I'd, you know, like your sort of big picture view on is whether this is really what we ought to be looking at, or looking down the road about where we might be with all of this. It seems that this is a cat and mouse game with terrorists. And, you know, the more, you know, surveillance and security is ratcheted up, the further it's, you know, the terrorist activity is just driven down. It's almost a ratcheting type of phenomenon. So if in the end game, if destructive potential is available in a small group of people who are determined terrorists, is it better to just at some point capitulate on the notion of privacy and focus more on what information is used for and retained rather than how it's collected?
So I'll start because I agree with you. The idea of saying you can't have this information without getting over certain kinds of humps, some speed bumps or other, appeals to people, to lawyers in particular, because we all think of the warrant requirement and the Fourth Amendment. But as a practical matter, when you look at how easy it is to gather this information, how easy and cheap it is to keep it, collect it, analyze it, the likelihood that it's not going to get used is near zero. We have multi-billion-dollar companies who have built their business model on the idea that they can give away stuff just in the hopes that they'll collect enough information and store it in ways that will become valuable to advertisers. And the idea that we would gather that information and use it to sell acai berry to people, but not to protect them and their families from terrorist attacks, strikes me as peculiar. And I think that the kinds of auditing capabilities that modern technology makes possible. The very cheapness of analyzing data makes it much more plausible that you can impose restrictions and then enforce them on the kinds of searches that are done. Ironically, I think this whole debate over Section 215 has set back what would be a much more forward-looking approach to privacy by 10 or 15 years, because that's precisely what NSA did. They gathered the information and then set it aside and watched very closely who had access to it on under what conditions. They were the canary in the coal mine, and they're dead on the bottom of the cage right now.
So I actually disagree, perhaps unsurprisingly. Stuart touched on the Fourth Amendment. I mean, it protects against searches and seizure, not just against use. And in terms of the forward-looking view of privacy, where the information is set aside and regulated, monitored, that view of privacy has been around for quite some time. The Fair Information Practice Principles is sort of the lifeblood for many individuals who work in privacy, not just privacy advocacy, but privacy compliance. It's a flexible framework, but each of the principles is supposed to work with each other. And there is a collection principle to narrowly collect only what you need. And there are use principles and security principles, so that the information that you do collect should be locked down. It should be monitored, only given accessible only by individuals who actually need it. And so forth. So I think that that view of privacy is already here, but that does not obviate a need for a collection principle. I think that many, including myself, view the collection itself as an important step in the process, and one that ought to be subject to restrictions. And lastly, I would... I forgot what I was going to say, but I remember it. Under Section 215, where they were collecting this information, there were several independent information sources, such as the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, the President's Review Group, and senators who were reform-minded, all of whom have had access to the classified record, who said that despite having all this information, it did not, in fact, contribute. I think that the quote in the PCLAW report is, there was not a single instance in which the information made a concrete difference in thwarting a terrorist investigation or a terrorist plot or identifying a new terrorist suspect. So just because you're able to collect it all does not, in fact, mean that it will be useful.
I don't disagree with that, although I would say we have not seen a massively foreign, prepared, trained, and planned attack since 9/11. That's really what this system was designed to deal with, not with people who self-radicalize and then take a rifle out and start shooting.
All right. Well, our lines are open, so we've got time to do another question or two. So if you'd like to ask a question of either our experts, here's a last call. Press star and then the pound key. Again, that's star and the pound key. Now, I guess one of the articles I was reading on this mentioned possibly an increased role for inspector generals for Section 215 orders. In I forget which version of it was. Is that something that's going to help someone who's concerned about civil liberties sleep better at night?
I think that was the House bill, wasn't it, Harley?
Is that the House bill?
No, there are provisions for the reports on business records. It's an examination of the minimization procedures and a few other items. These are not, we think that these are helpful. They mostly are adding on to requirements that are already in statute, but these are not very high on the priority list for many groups. You know, that being said, we don't want them to go, but we view some of the other things that we've discussed here as being more important.
All right, well, it looks like we've exhausted the questions, but we still have a few minutes left, so I guess if there's any any related topics that we've discussed earlier that you that either of you wanted to get to, the floor is open. Feel free to bring them up now while we've got some more time. And if there's nothing else, I guess we could do closing statements. So I'll leave it up to either Stuart or Harley if you'd there's anything else you'd like to bring up.
Well, let me raise one issue, because one of the things I'm struck by is that we're worried about cataclysmic attacks on the United States when we're talking about the National Security Agency's surveillance capabilities, and we have now written a bill that says, you know, if you're trying to stop cataclysmic attacks, there's 100 hoops you have to go through and on 100 limitations, none of which apply to ordinary embezzlement investigations by the Southern District of New York or FBI investigations of bank robberies. And oddly, the Senate bill carves out the FBI from many of the restrictions, as though to reaffirm the idea that we care less about national security than about street crime. And I'm puzzled by that. Obviously, Harley, you were part of the discussions on this. What was the thinking about carving out the FBI?
We were certainly not behind the carve out for the FBI. And I will say that, yes, we are also concerned about street crime, not just cataclysmic attack. There is an emergency provision within the USA Freedom Act for the collection of call detail records that adds on to emergency provisions already in statute. So for, in the case of an impending cataclysmic attack, the government is able to jump a few hoops to get the information as long as they do, jump through the hoops later, basically. But I think that the main distinction is, between the use of the national security surveillance authorities and the criminal authorities is that the criminal authorities, to our knowledge, have not yet been used for bulk collection of metadata of every American. That was a troubling use of authority and is what has sparked this reform effort. If we find out that it is being used, that is the criminal authorities are being used in a similarly overbroad manner, I'm sure that there will be a reform effort directed at that use as well.
Any other thoughts, Stuart? Or we did actually have one more caller pop on the line, so I think we can do got time for
one. That's fine. Let's answer some questions.
Fantastic.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. Back. There's another matter, which is surveillance directed at what might be called and is being called domestic terrorism, a term that is becoming increasingly applied to a wide variety of activities that in the past we would not have regarded as terroristic. There's a recent report, Understanding Law Enforcement Intelligence Processes, report to the Office of University Programs, Science and Technology Directorate, U.S. Department of Homeland Security, July 2014, which conducted a survey of law enforcement agents of different agencies across the country and identified their assessment of the level of threat from various sources. And they mostly focused on domestic threats, many of whom, of which seem to be rather fanciful, and yet were given high ratings as the cause of concern. It seems that this hunting for boogie bears is perhaps as much of a threat to our civil liberties as much of the surveillance we've been discussing.
John, if I can, I'll offer two thoughts on that. First, if you ask local law enforcement what kinds of threats they're worried about, they're going to give you local threats, because for the same reason that the New Yorker had that great cartoon of what the United States looks like from Manhattan, where half the map is taken up by the you know, from First Avenue to Ninth, and then Iowa and Berkeley are out there somewhere. Everybody has their own perspective, and it's very local. We shouldn't let those perspectives drive national policy, and I don't think they do. The kind of intelligence that we're getting on the people who want to kill us and who have substantial capabilities and are indeed killing lots of people they disagree with right this minute in Iraq and Syria tells us that they would like nothing better than to surpass al-Qaeda's attacks on the United States if they can find a way to do it. Those are the attacks that we should be focused on, and I would certainly agree with you that it's a bad idea to start getting hung up on the possibility of anti-GM activists tromping on crops as the equivalent of an al-Qaeda attack. But I don't see that happening at the national level.
I would say that we are troubled by the definition of terrorism as used in many criminal statutes, where if you are committing violence or threatening violence, no matter how small that violence may be, to prove a political point or to intimidate an individual, that this becomes terrorism, and that covers a very broad range of activity, and is inextricably tied with a lot of First Amendment expression. So that I agree with you on the troubling breadth of the statutes as applies to individuals that we may not have viewed as terrorists in the past. That being said, that type of activity, I do believe that the threat is real at the local level. But I would agree with Stuart that at least at the national level, the types of attacks that these rather sweeping surveillance authorities should be focused on are the ones that will cause widespread damage.
And speaking as a longtime Federalist member, there is a tendency on the part of folks on the right to tell each other scary bedtime stories about how the Obama administration is going to come for them. I mean, the administration is not one that I support, and many of its policies are extraordinarily paternalistic and foolish and not especially competently carried out. But I do not see any incipient signs of authoritarian government attacking people on the right, the idea that NSA or the CIA could be used for that purpose, I think, is really a figment of the imagination of the right.
You know, it's not just on the right, I think.
No, you're right.
although I also don't think it's such a figment. I mean, the Obama administration, I personally do not think that we live in some sort of totalitarian dictatorship, which is sometimes an opinion that you hear expressed on the internet from both the left and the right. However, I think that a lot of an overarching point in reform discussions like this, like with the USA Freedom Act, is not just directed at the current government. We do not know what the government will be like in a few generations. We simply don't. And the country may change rather radically, and an administration that we view as not being a fascist today could change. It has happened before in many other countries, and one of the ways that we can prevent that is by fine-tuning our laws, and that is what we're trying to do.
Well, this is Christian. Morgan, We're right here at the end of the call, and I want to thank both of our speakers for a very insightful call, a great discussion of the issues. Thank you to our audience for joining us. A quick programming note, as was mentioned previously, please join us Thursday, August 14th, noon Eastern Time, for a conversation with two privacy and liberty oversight board members, Rachel Brand and Jim Dempsey, to discuss their new Section 702 report, which should be of particular interest to anyone on this call. check out the Center for Democracy and Technology's website, as well as Steptoe and Johnson's blog. And also, for those of you who may have missed the beginning of this call or want to listen to it again, this podcast will be up on our website at fedsoc.org, where you can always check out this call as well as every other call that we do and download. And with that, I think we're adjourned, and please join us again Thursday at noon.
So this has been episode 31 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe & Johnson. We are officially on hiatus, and I, for one, am definitely going back on hiatus through the end of August. We hope you'll join us in September when we once again provide insights into the latest events in technology, security, privacy, and government. Our first guest on September 2nd will be David Hoffman, the Chief Privacy Officer at Intel. We're looking forward to you joining us.